Hello, and welcome to the Asian segment of our June 2025 podcast. We'll cover the just completing Japanese main season, review some of the other Asian markets that have had their 2025 seasons so far, and provide a preview of the upcoming India season. As our Japanese research team in Tokyo are still wrapping up their work, we're fortunate to have Mark Goldstein, our head of US research, talking on Japan season today. As many of our listeners will know, Mark is an expert on Japanese corporate governance as well as on the US. Then we'll move to Glenn Maguire, who heads all of our Asia ex-Japan research teams and is based in Sydney. Glenn and some of his senior Asia market leads will provide their perspectives of the main 2025 Asia season so far. We'll hear from our South Korea research lead, Candice Kim, on the early and intense Korea proxy season and developments there. And from South and Southeast Asia senior lead team lead Johan Villacorte, who will cover developments in Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia. Then, last in this segment, our research head for India, Aditi Uttamchandani, will give us a preview of the upcoming India proxy season from her home base in Mumbai. So, we'll start with the Japan season and Mark Goldstein. Mark, welcome. Japan season is winding down now, but what are some of the key takeaways from this year's annual meetings?
Well, Georgina, ISS published benchmark research reports on just shy of 1,900 Japanese meetings this month. That's down a little from the number last year, which reflects the Tokyo Stock Exchange's recent moves to shrink the size of the benchmark topics index that many investors track. Many of the trends we've observed in recent years have continued in 2025, including increases in board independence and gender diversity. 97.5% of companies have at least one director assessed as an independent outsider, and 13% have a majority of such directors. 82.4% of Japanese boards now include at least one female director, and 41.3% have two or more women directors. If we look back at 2012, those diversity numbers were 9.4% and 1.2%, respectively. Among large cap companies in the Topix 100, nearly 89% have two or more women on the board, and close to 40% have a majority of directors who meet the ISS criteria for independence. Another trend that continued this year was the increase in the number of shareholder proposals. There were a total of 514 shareholder proposals at 125 Japanese companies in the first half of 2025, both of which were new records. Proposal topics ranged from director nominations to dividend increases and share buybacks to environmental proposals. And in the latter category, we had not just the usual Japanese anti-nuclear proposals at the electric power companies, but also climate-related proposals at the three mega banks, as well as at three trading companies and one electric utility.
And what were some of the key meetings in Japan this year, Mark?
Well, as always happens, there were a few scandals this year which were very much on the minds of investors in Japan. One of those was a case of insider trading by a former employee of the Tokyo Stock Exchange, whose parent company trades as Japan Exchange Group, Incorporated. The employee had advanced information about upcoming mergers and tipped off his father, who used the information to trade. Both father and son were convicted, and the incident suggested a lack of sufficient compliance training and monitoring on the part of the exchange. In another incident, a former senior employee in the stock transfer agency business unit at Sumitomo Mitsui Trust was indicted for improper trading over a period of many years. And although he was found to have acted alone, the incident was nonetheless a black eye for the bank, particularly in light of its important role in Japan's investment and stewardship infrastructure. But things have been particularly bad at Nomura Holdings over the past year and a half. The company's main operating unit, Nomura Securities, was fined by regulators last fall for manipulating prices in the Japanese government bond market. Meanwhile, in separate incidents, one former salesperson was arrested for fraud and a second for robbery, arson, and attempted murder after he allegedly drugged an 80-year-old client, stole cash from her, and then set her building on fire. The meetings for all three of these companies, Japan Exchange, Sumitomo Mitsui Trust, and Nomura Holdings, have already taken place. Another company that has got a lot of attention this year is Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group, which is the holding company for Japan's largest bank and whose meeting is coming up on June 27th. The financial services agency penalized the bank and two other operating units last year for, among other things, improperly sharing client information within the group against those clients' instructions. MUFG also has seven shareholder proposals on its agenda this year, requesting everything from additional climate reporting to a share buyback program to the removal of the punctuation between the words financial and group in the company's Japanese name. An unidentified shareholder has also nominated three directors to the board, one of whom will be familiar to longtime Japanese scandal watchers, Takafumi Horie, the former CEO of Livedoor. So it seems fitting that the next company we discuss is Fuji Media Holdings, whose meeting is on June 25th, as Livedoor's attempt to buy an affiliate of Fuji Television back in 2005 led to securities and accounting fraud charges against Horie and largely ended his meteoric rise. This time around, one of Fuji Television's star personalities was accused of sexual misconduct, causing advertisers to flee the network and leading to a net loss for the fiscal year. This was compounded by the findings of an investigative committee that instances of sexual harassment were widespread at the company and were to some extent condoned by the corporate culture. Dalton Investments, a U.S. fund, has nominated a full slate of 12 directors at Fuji Media. However, they're not exactly running against incumbents as the top executives resigned and all but one of the company's own director nominees are new to the board. It's worth noting here that Fuji Media, like all Japanese broadcast companies, limits the aggregate voting power of foreign investors to just 20%.
Thanks, Mark. And quite a few high-profile scandals this year, for sure. You mentioned Dalton Investments, and they've been quite active in Japan, I understand.
Indeed, they have. Dalton also submitted three shareholder proposals at Toyota Industries, which is an affiliate of Toyota Motor. Dalton proposed to amend the articles to include language promoting mindfulness of the share price and cost of capital, to require a majority of outside directors on the board, and to introduce a performance-based stock plan for directors to promote greater share ownership and alignment of interests. Toyota Motor and its chairman, Akio Toyoda, just recently announced a $33 billion bid to take Toyota Industries private, and this has attracted a lot of criticism over the valuation and conflicts of interest. However, no items related to that bid were on the ballot at Toyota Industries' June 10th AGM, or for that matter, at Toyota Motors' AGM. Finally, I'd like to talk about Keisei Electric Railway, whose meeting is coming up on June 27th. The company is facing a vote no campaign from UK multi-strategy fund Palliser Capital, targeting six of the 15 director nominees, the current president, the three outside directors who serve on the Nomination and Compensation Committee, and two new executive director nominees. Palliser criticizes the company for poor capital management, exemplified by its large ownership stake in Tokyo Disneyland operator Oriental Land Company and a newly entered cross-shareholding arrangement with retail giant Aeon Company. Palliser also highlights the negative market reaction to the company's new midterm management plan and notes that there are no performance-based elements in Keisei's executive compensation plan. Finally, Palliser takes issue with the board's rejection of its own proposed director candidates.
Thanks, Mark, for running us through another eventful Japan season. And next, let me turn to Glenn Maguire, our head of Asia ex-Japan research. Welcome, Glenn. Glenn, before we dive into specific markets with your market experts and leads, can you give us a sense of any overarching governance themes across Asia ex-Japan this proxy season?
Thanks, Georgina. What we're observing across many markets in Asia ex-Japan is a deepening of structural governance reform that reflects both regulatory maturation and rising shareholder expectations. There's a clear regional trend toward increasing board accountability, with more pressure on companies to enhance board independence, formalize CEO succession planning, and improve disclosure transparency. Shareholder activity is becoming more targeted, especially in markets such as South Korea and India, where there's concern about misalignment between ownership and control. Institutional investors are increasingly using tools like cumulative voting or influencing director nominations. Meanwhile, regulators from Vietnam to Indonesia are taking a more proactive stance, especially on related party transactions, ESG reporting, and minority shareholder protections. The overall trend in the region is clear. Governance is becoming more investor responsive and globally aligned.
Thanks, Glenn. And we'll move to South Korea next and welcoming Candice Kim. Candice, the very intensive South Korea season, one of the earliest globally, ended a couple of months ago. What were the standout governance themes?
Hi, Georgina. The 2025 proxy season in South Korea was shaped by increasing regulatory attention to structural governance challenges and growing engagement from many minority shareholders, a continued concentration of AGMs, progress in hybrid meetings, and evolving discussions around fiduciary duty and board independence reflected the shifting landscape. Shareholder activism increased in both scope and sophistication, especially around Article of Amendments and cumulative voting for director elections. Shareholders continued to propose amendments to articles of incorporation to address perceived imbalances in influence between controlling and minority shareholders. These efforts were reflected in increased regulatory discourse around structural governance issues.
Thanks, Candice, and good to hear you. Board independence has long been an important point of debate in Korea. Can you walk us through the latest developments in board structures and also in CEO succession planning?
Without a clear separation of ownership and management, concerns persist on the true independence of many boards and the proper performance of directors' fiduciary duties. Over 90% of board chairs are inside directors, with 77% concurrently serving as CEO. Only approximately 1% of companies within the ISS Korea universe has appointed a lead independent director, and these are primarily in the financial sector. Notably, on the positive side, around 54% of major companies disclosed the CEO succession plan, and 81% appointed an independent director as chair of the nominating committee. Approximately 55% of companies that had directors previously associated with material governance concerns renominated those directors. Among the 65 companies involved, oversight issues were more prevalent among financial firms, while other cases involved misconduct and troubles.
And we've heard quite a lot about shareholder activism and cumulative voting in Korea in past years as well. How are these mechanisms evolving and what's the regulatory response so far?
Discussions around vote allocations, including cumulative voting, became more prominent this year. However, regulatory mechanisms to mitigate potential proxy voting abuse remains limited. Cumulative voting continues to generate debates among legislators, market participants, and governance advocates.
Thank you, Candice, and always interesting to hear about South Korea's governance journey and its intense season. And I'll next bring in Johan Villacorte to talk about a few of the Asian markets we don't often have the chance to report on in our Bulletin Series podcasts. So welcome, Johan. First, Vietnam. Vietnam introduced a bilingual corporate disclosure requirement this year. How significant is this shift for foreign investors?
Yes, Regina. The availability of the English disclosures was a welcome development for Vietnam, expanding accessibility for many non-Vietnamese investors. In the past, companies were only required to provide disclosures in Vietnamese. However, the new regulations required listed companies and public companies, among others, to disclose information in Vietnamese and in English.
And Johan, I understand that an earthquake occurred in the middle of the Thailand proxy season. And aside from its human tragedy, it resulted, amongst other things, in a corporate scandal. How did the earthquake and the related scandal impact proxy season dynamics?
For Thailand, the earthquake in March did not in itself have significant disruptions within the schedule of the AGMs. However, Italian Thai Development, or ITD, was put in the spotlight. Its joint venture was the contractor for the government building that collapsed during the earthquake. It was alleged that substandard materials were used for the construction. Personnel involved in the project, including ITD's managing director, were arrested. The case is still ongoing.
And moving to Indonesia next, where I understand that there was a new Indonesian sovereign wealth fund launched this year. Can you give us some insight into that and anything else notable in Indonesia this year for investors?
Indonesia launched its second sovereign wealth fund called Danantara in February. Government transferred its holdings in state-owned enterprises to Danantara. Nonetheless, the government will retain control over these companies. So far, there have been no notable proposals at listed SOEs related to Danantara. In March, the Financial Services Authority allowed share buybacks without shareholder approval for 6 months. This was primarily triggered by the decline of the Jakarta Composite Index. Out of the companies we covered so far this year, 25 will exercise its buyback authority. And out of these 25, three companies sought approval for additional buyback mandates. The additional buyback mandates should not overlap with the buyback authorities without shareholder approval.
Thank you, Johan. And finally, in this Asian section of the podcast, I'm pleased to welcome Aditi Uttamchandani, our Head of India Research, for insights into the upcoming India proxy season. Welcome, Aditi. The proxy season in India is about to kick off. What trends from recent years are continuing to shape agendas this year?
Hi, Georgina. So for the past 2 years, there has been an increase in the number of special and extraordinary meetings in India. And we expect an increase in agenda items again this season. This can be attributed to several amendments to the listing regulation. Firstly, director appointment-related agenda items were recurrent in 2024 season, as regulations require shareholder approval within 3 months from when a nominee is first appointed or reappointed by the board. Appointments are therefore no longer restricted to AGM and proposed throughout the year. Secondly, secretary auditor appointments, which only required a board approval, are now subjected to shareholder approval at AGMs after amendment to listing regulation to seek shareholder approval, which is with effect from FY25-26. The regulations have also capped the tenure of their appointment to 2 terms of 5 years each. Additional agenda item will be added to the annual meetings during the season. Since no transition period was provided for appointment of tenured secretarial auditors and the law does not take into account prior tenure, such proposals will be a common theme. Hence, for India Benchmark Research, we will be recommending to vote for such appointments for the first term to provide a transition window and allowing for fresh secretarial appointments to be appointed after this term. Thirdly, shareholder approvals requested for related party transactions above INR 10 billion also grew in 24. Increase was mainly due to acquisitions, change in control of entities, or changing business structure that required fresh approval for transactions with related entities. A similar trend is expected during this year.
And related party transactions are always closely watched in India. Can you tell us a bit more about the new disclosure standards and their implications for companies and for investors?
So in February 2025, India regulator SEBI announced a new set of disclosure standards which have been formulated by Industry Standard Forum in consultation with the regulators. The standards set minimum information that companies would be required to provide to audit committees as well as shareholders when seeking approval for RPTs. These requirements were to come into effect from 1st April 2025. These changes were mostly welcome as there is a lot of information required about related party transaction and around pricing that would be provided to the shareholders, although at the same time it increases for investors the complexity for analyzing such transactions. On the other hand, companies were concerned about increase in compliance burden, which could also slow down decision making. Hence, SEBI extended the deadline from 1st April 25 to 1st July 25 in order to provide more time to the companies, as well as they have asked the industry associations to simplify the standard based on the feedback received from various stakeholders and release a revised guideline.
Thanks, Aditi. Are there any high-profile AGMs coming up or cases investors may want to be paying particular attention to for this India season?
So at this time, IndusInd Bank stands out. It reported a USD 175 million accounting discrepancy related to derivatives. This led to executive resignations and regulatory actions. SEBI's interim order alleges insider trading and governance lapses, with further investigations underway ahead of this AGM. That's something to watch out for.
Thank you, Mark, Glenn, Candice, Johan, and Aditi for joining us on the Asia section of our June Bulletin podcast today. This wraps up not only this podcast, but also this year's ISS Bulletin podcast series as well. Thanks to our speakers and huge thanks to you, our clients and listeners, for tuning in. We hope that you found this final instalment, as well as this year's earlier Bulletin podcast series, a helpful and informative companion to season and in your work. Links to all episodes of our 2025 season podcasts are available for download. Please do watch your emails for information on future webinars and other broadcasts and publications. From all of us at ISS, thanks again for joining us and goodbye for now.